I have got to stop playing Tetris because I play Tetris too often, the app on my phone, and now all I see are like...
My face is just some shifting
pieces
blocks.
And how I need to fit them in. I'm deleting it off my phone.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and with me in the studio, it's Hot Takedown's well-coiffed correspondent, Kate Fagan, and ESPNW columnist. You've got a great elevation to the coif today.
Kate. I got a haircut.
Oh, well, that's
what
would
happened.
Do it.
And then I didn't wash my hair this morning, so this is called bedhead.
No, it's called like you're trying to make the haircut hair last as long as possible.
I think it has
people
tremendous upside potential.
I'm not going to wash my hair for at least 3 or 4 days because, you know, they just style it better in the actual salon.
I think you're excused dirty hair for, as you said, 3 to 4 days, and then past that, you start to get some funny looks. Also with us, Neil Statman Payne.
Hey, Chad.
538 editor, writer, sports person.
Sports human.
Yes. Kate, before we get rolling with today's show, do you have a hot take for us, is my understanding?
I did. I think we should listen to this hot take that I think is just screaming around the internet.
Great.
Let's take a listen. This is Kate Fagan.
And I'm Catherine Budig.
And we're launching a new show, Free Cookies, a new podcast from ESPNW about sports, wellness, and pop culture.
You can find us in the Listen tab of the ESPN app and on Apple Podcasts.
It was very hot, that take, didn't you think?
Hot track behind you guys.
What do you guys think about that music? Anyway, people need to go download the podcast, Free Cookies.
Free Cookies.
The teaser should be up today,
Episode zero.
The first episode is tomorrow, May 3rd, with Abby Wambach talking about how she knew she had a drinking problem.
Interesting. And so the show is about the intersection, as you said, of sports wellness and culture, and so is this like a sort of slice of your brain that we get every week?
I think everything I do at ESPN, actually except this, is like really usually pretty serious. Even Around the Horn is a lot of serious topics, and Outside the Lines is really serious. So this is supposed to be more hanging out, personality-driven, but we have awesome guests that we talk about, like Tony Reale, Around the Horn host, is coming on. His topic is, quote-unquote, gripping life too hard. So we get pretty serious in that
Just
one,
a little fresh air.
Yeah.
A little fresh cookie.
Doesn't want free cookies?
Free cookie, fresh cookie.
Thank you for playing that hot take.
Absolutely. All right. So on today's show, we are going to talk about the NHL playoffs and what is happening with the Washington Capitals, who nearly blew Game 3 last night after falling down 0-2 already in their second round series. We'll also do a career appreciation of Paul Pierce, the retiring Clippers player, but really a Celtics player, I think, in all of our minds. His Nets years, all of us New Yorkers are sort of trying to look away from. And then our significant digit, when a telling number of the world of sports is brought to us. But first, let's begin with a segment on the way that race works in the NFL by position and why certain positions are more black or white than others. And with us to talk about the racial divide in the NFL is Jane McManus, an adjunct professor at Columbia Journalism School and a former ESPN sports writer. Jane, welcome to Hot Takedown.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Jane, you wrote a piece in The Undefeated with Jason Reed about sort of how rosters are constructed in the NFL and why it is that certain positions are played by predominantly black or predominantly white players. Just before we sort of get going with the analysis that you did, you know, where did this idea come from? Was this something you noticed casually offhand over the years, or was there sort of data that you were presented with that then made you go and report it out further?
Well, I think my first pitch on this story was in 2010 because it was something that I noticed. I started covering, you know, the league in like 2008, and you know, I think it's one of those things that's right in front of our faces and we don't really see it anymore. And it kind of got me thinking, and I started talking to coaches and other reporters about it, like, you know, and nobody really seemed to be all that concerned about it. Nobody really thought, well, this is something that, you know, is being kind of manicured like this. It was kind of like everybody was like, oh, I wonder how that got to be that way. And, you know, talked about then it seemed to have some sort of like complicated mechanism. So the idea for me was I wanted to get the numbers on it. I felt like, you know, it's something that you see, but you really need the data to back up whether or not, you know, this is real, what the actual percentages are. And also, you know, it would be helpful, I was thinking, it would be helpful also to have, like, college data as well to see what the trends were. If you could say, well, this is happening less and less or more and more. But luckily, the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sports had been keeping data on it since the late 1990s. So I presented this story, and, you know, kind of people were like, yeah, that's really interesting, but we don't really know how to – It's a huge, ambitious story. We don't really know how to grasp it. And I got into a conversation with Jason Reed at The Undefeated like a year ago, and he was like, you know, I was thinking about this story for Corners. And I was like, yeah, it's really a lot bigger than Corners, though. It's kind of everywhere. And he was like, let's do it together. And I said, yeah. And that's how it got started.
Jane, we'll definitely put this piece on the page for Hot Takedown so people can see some of these numbers and the graphic here that shows the NFL breakdown of race and position throughout the years. But can you at least offer some of the numbers of certain positions for the listeners to highlight exactly which positions are seem to be broken down by race?
Right. Well, the big one probably is cornerback, which is, at the NFL level anyway, almost exclusively a position played by black players. And then you have the thing that stood out to us when we actually got the numbers, though, was the center position, because the offensive line tends to break down 50-50, and yet centers in the NFL are about 80% white. And because the up-the-middle positions, right, quarterback and center, had been seen as the positions, at least traditionally, and we're talking going back decades and decades, those had been seen as the positions where you needed leadership and you needed intellect. And that was a position that was overwhelmingly white, we felt, indicated perhaps that some of these subconscious notions that we may have about leadership and that had plagued the quarterback position, right, and who had gotten opportunities at quarterback, that might be in play with center as well. But because the idea wasn't quite so strong with centers, that if you are excluding black players, that you're making larger statements about, you know, race in general, that it hadn't really changed at that level and there hadn't been more of an effort to integrate that position as much.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most fascinating parts of this piece for me was how much of society's racial bias at large is reflected within the league, partly because of things like that, where the league apparently has slotted people based on what is most crucial, and the crucial positions are the ones that went to white players over black players. And what I also found really compelling and interesting was that there's a way to look at the numbers over time, and the numbers essentially haven't changed in the last 15 years. It goes from 1999 to 2014. Even quarterback, where I think now we have more black African American stars at quarterback than, at least in my memory, we used to. It's still essentially 80% white quarterbacks versus 20% black quarterbacks. And so, to bring it all around, you know, what was telling for me was that we have, you know, a society that often likes to tell itself that it's coming to grips with its racial past and its racial bias, but actually maybe not that much is changing underneath. And I saw some of that reflected in the NFL data as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the reason that those numbers are similar, but we have this perception that things have changed, is because we have starting quarterbacks now, you know, Cam Newton and Russell Wilson and Colin Kaepernick for a while and RG3, where they were very visible and they were starters, and it felt like that they were changing kind of the prototype of what a starting quarterback was in the league. But the reason the numbers haven't changed so much is because, despite the fact that you have these very visible quarterbacks, the bulk of the quarterbacks in the NFL are backups. And with the backups, you tend to have a certain core player, number of players that are kind of recycled among teams. And it turns out that, you know, the thinking behind it is, from some of the NFL folks that we talked to, is that, you know, white players tend to get recycled a little bit more, whereas black players get a chance, maybe a second chance, but they don't really end up floating around teams as backups, as the just-in-case kind of players, in the same way that the white players do.
And Jane, a lot of the sorting is happening like long before these players hit the NFL, right? Like it's happening when they're in youth football and in high school and things like that, where they kind of get diverted to certain positions based on these kind of stereotypes.
Yeah, and that was fascinating to think about too. And somebody that I talked to for that is George Whitfield, who is a quarterback coach, and he is himself black. And so he's paid a lot of attention to, over the years, this idea of race and sorting. And he also goes to a lot of these youth camps, and his particular eye is on quarterback, and he still sees black players sorted into wide receiver when they may want to play quarterback. And, you know, part of that is there's also a level of self-selection. I see you more as an offensive lineman as opposed to a defensive lineman, or, you know, these things. There's a self-sort going on among players because of affinities, perhaps. Again, none of this is overt. None of it is done because, you know, overt racism necessarily, but it is this kind of affinity sorting that's happening, and it can be happening among players, or it could be happening with a coach who sees two really talented players and he wants to put, you know, one of them at wide receiver and one of them at quarterback, and he may think that the black player, for example, is faster, so, and that might be, you know, based on actual facts, and it also might be based on assumptions about what players are capable of that are correlated to race.
Jane, right after you and Jason in this article discuss sorting, you have the anecdote about a black player at center and what it would take for a team or a coach to choose a black player to play center. And, you know, basically it's like he's got to not just play as well as white centers, but probably better to overcome whatever prejudice exists, you know, subconscious or not, in someone's mind. And it got me thinking, too, about how if you looked in the NBA and you said, Becky Hammon, all right, if she gets a head coaching job, she almost has to, like, win an NBA title to ensure that another team is going to hire a female head coach. She can't just be average, right? She has to be better than average to start paving the way to overcome some of those biases. What information, what conversations, what data led you guys to realize that, like, to break down some of these barriers, you have to just be better and not just the same?
There were a couple people that we spoke to. Harry Edwards is one of them, who's a sociologist out of Berkeley. He's been thinking about these ideas for decades, and he has actually consulted with the 49ers and somebody who's a noted voice in this field, and he really kind of set the tone with that, is that because he's been seeing this clearly for decades, and it's kind of, you know, there's the old saw, right? And if you're going to be an X in this business, then you have to be twice as good as the Ys. And that's kind of the way I think that it works. And you could apply this, you know, not just to the NFL football field, but to a lot of other places. And I think it's anybody that you have that is talented at something and then has to defeat the idea of type in addition to being able to excel at the job. So this is something that goes way farther than that. And then the other person who was really instrumental was Malcolm Gladwell. And he's an author of The Tipping Point and Outliers and all of these different books, and has thought a lot about kind of, you know, what are our standard assumptions of things and how does that hold us back. And in this situation, he said that how it holds us back is that, you know, black players in general may be faster because of certain biological advantages, but that doesn't mean that that speed is exclusive to African Americans, and that by not including white players in how you look at different positions, for example, Christian McCaffrey is the running back who was drafted by the Panthers, then you are leaving talent on the cutting room floor, right? You're going to overlook and you're going to completely ignore someone because they don't fit whatever your prototype is. So in that sense, you know, the idea is you want the best person for the job. But if you're sorting just for category first, then you're going to exclude a certain number of people for a job, whether it's quarterback or running back or wide receiver or corner, or even kicker and punter, which we haven't even gotten to yet, which are almost exclusively white at the NFL level. But you're going to leave a lot of talented people then out of the equation as finalists for the job.
Yeah, and that seems like something that even in something as kind of cutthroat and ruthless and hyper-focused on winning as the NFL, that if the talent pool isn't there by the time that they're drafting players, for instance, then there really isn't something that the pro teams can really do about it. It seems like it has to kind of happen downstream in the talent, you know, development process.
Yeah, exactly, and a lot of people noted that. And that's part of the reason why kind of when Jason and I were, I mean, we discussed this for a year, every time, you know, I'd get an interview, I'd call him and we'd talk about it. Every time he'd get an interview, we'd talk, you know, when he got Jason Sehorn, you know, we talked about Jason Sehorn and how that fit into all of this. And the fact that Dennis Thurman, who was the coach who encouraged Jason Sehorn to tell the Giants he wanted to play corner as their safety, Dennis Thurman is a black DB coach. So here you had a black coach telling a white player to fight for his right to play the position he wanted to. I mean, to me, that was just like so emblematic of kind of what this whole idea is about.
So, Jane, before we let you go, I do want to ask sort of where you see this heading in the next few years or decade or two. You know, is this something where when you looked at the data and also talked to people, people felt as though the NFL was starting to break out of itself and its old habits, or is this pretty hard-grained and or ingrained and therefore this is going to be the way it is for a little bit?
You know, that was one of the most interesting things is I just don't think people have seen it. I think it's something that's kind of been happening and that people don't really see it. And it's like some people would look and say, yeah, I mean, I talked to LeVar Arrington about it, who's a former linebacker for Washington, and he was like, no one can talk about this without sounding racist. So let me know when this story runs, because I want to see who was able to talk about it. And, you know, so I think that's part of it, is that it's not really seen anymore. It's right in front of us, but it's not even seen. And I don't expect it to change, again, because I think you're right. It's those downstream issues. And, you know, until people actually see it and examine it, you know, this is a league that really likes to stick with tradition in some ways and where thinking is often duplicative among teams. So I don't know that I'd necessarily see it changing. I mean, the thing that could possibly change it is that, you know, let's say Christian McCaffrey coming in as a running back. If there are the next three drafts, you have eight white running backs going in the first round. That's something that could change it.
All right, Jane McManus, thanks so much for coming on and talking about this great piece.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Thanks, Jane.
Okay, let's put football down and get a quick word from one of Hot Takedown's sponsors. Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by 1-800-Flowers. Mother's Day is almost here, and for a lot of us, we're not going to be able to spend the day with mom in person. But with 1-800-Flowers.com, you can still show your mom how much you care. Because right now, 1-800-Flowers.com is giving Hot Takedown listeners an exclusive 30 for 30 offer. 30 assorted tulips for $30. That's only $1 per tulip. All you have to do is pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. These tulips are beautiful and bright, a mix of orange, yellow, and pink blooms. They're picked at their peak from premier farms and shipped overnight to ensure freshness and your mom's enjoyment. 30 assorted tulips for only $30. It's an amazing offer, but it expires on Tuesday. So to order 30 stunning assorted tulips for only $30, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code TAKEDOWN. That's 1-800-Flowers.com, code TAKEDOWN. Hurry, because the offer ends on Tuesday. Okay, now moving on to hockey. Kate Fagan had to step out for this segment. She will be back later in the show. But with us to fill Kate's void, a very large void, is Craig Custance, an ESPN.com senior writer. He writes about hockey. We're going to talk about hockey. Hi, Craig.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Going well. Thanks for coming on. So I think let's start with the Washington Capitals, who had the best record in the NHL during the regular season, and yet they're down 2-1 to the Pittsburgh Penguins, almost down 3-0 after blowing a two-goal lead in Monday night's game, but they held on and won in overtime. And, you know, we spoke at length about the Shattenkirk addition during the season and how the Capitals were going for broke this season by basically doing the kinds of trades that you see in other leagues quite often, which is just sort of a win-now trade. And yet, here they are in a 2-1 hole. Craig, what's going on in Washington? Is it the same thing that's always going on in Washington come playoff time?
I know. It's one of those things where I really try hard to separate the current team and roster from any previous failures. And it's because I have a hard time saying, you know, something that happened to the Washington Capitals 10 or even 5 years ago has anything to do with the current team. And you want to give them the benefit of the doubt. And then things start to happen like we saw in games 1 and 2, where the Capitals for long stretches of time were dominant in those games. And you know, the advanced stats were off the charts in terms of their puck possession numbers. I'm looking like right now in terms of their Corsi and how many shot attempts they control at even strength. in the playoffs, they're the number two team right now, and things should be going really well for the Capitals if that kind of extrapolates itself out to wins. But sadly, it doesn't always do that, and we saw the Penguins be very opportunistic. They've kind of developed a counterpunch, a counterattack type mentality, and you know, Sidney Crosby, Phil Kessel, Evgeny Malkin, those stars, they only need the smallest sliver of space to have success, and we saw it happen in those first two games.
Yeah, so Neil, this may be a question for you, which is when a team has good analytic fundamentals on Corsi and Fenwick and whatnot, I don't know, we've spoken about those stats in the past on Hot Takedown, they're basically puck possession stats because possessing the puck is what leads to success in hockey. Mm-hmm. Is there a sort of go-to game plan to counteract teams that have good puck possession? You know, is the NHL wise to how to disrupt a team like the Capitals in a seven-game series, for example?
Maybe. I mean, so much of the puck possession stuff is concentrated at even strength because that's sort of the way in which the numbers are kind of least tainted by a lot of other factors. So I'm wondering if maybe, you know, focusing on special teams might be a way to kind of counteract a team like that. And again, like in such a small sample of the playoffs, do you just see like enormous swings of luck, I feel like, or things that are not necessarily explained by the possession numbers that can really determine a playoff series? And right now it's kind of impossible for us to pull out the luck factor from other things that teams are doing. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this, Craig?
Yeah, no. Well, to your point, like if you look at the top Corsi percentages right now in the postseason, it's the Minnesota Wild over 60%, which is a crazy number. And of course, the Minnesota Wild are sitting at home watching the playoffs. So
right.
Washington's 2, Columbus is 3 again. And I don't think it's any coincidence that 2 and 3 are both teams that played against the Penguins, because what they've been able to do is they've blocked a lot of shots and you know, they've tried to keep shots out of the slot in high quality scoring areas, and then they've counterpunched and they've gone on odd man rushes and they've scored. And so Columbus and Washington are getting a lot of shot attempts in against the Penguins. The Penguins seem pretty content to block those shots and then try to go on the attack the other way. And it becomes the anti-Corsi then if that's your game plan.
Yeah, and so many of these possession stats don't take into account, like you said, the slot, you know, the locations of shots that, you know, it's very possible that they're missing things if you just look at the kind of raw, you know, even if it's on even strength shot differentials that, you know, the quality of the shots do matter. And that's also a subject of a lot of debate among hockey stat heads about how persistent, you know, shot quality is. But I think if you're getting shots in that kind of home plate area in front of the net between the circles, that, you know, that does tend to be a better predictor than if you're bombing away from the point or something like that.
Well, right. And I mean, you're right. This is a debate, because if you're talking about over the course of a 82 game season, it tends to work itself out. And those Corsi numbers tend to be pretty predictive. But when you're talking about a seven-game series, you're exactly right 100%. And I think there's an analytics website called Corsica Hockey, and they also measure scoring chances for and scoring chances against. And so Columbus, for example, again, out of the playoffs with a strong Corsi, they had 40 scoring chances versus 49 against playing the Penguins. And that just shows you that the Penguins are getting higher quality chances, and that's what the Penguins would tell you too.
So, but what may affect that going forward is Sidney Crosby's injury. And Craig, can you give us the latest after he got hurt in Monday night's game 3?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm at their practice facility right now. They're going to hit the ice at 12:15. I don't anticipate Sidney Crosby being on the ice, but we just don't know for sure. I mean, everyone's being pretty tight-lipped about the severity of the injury. Typically, after a game like that, we'll get, you know, at a minimum, it's an upper body or a lower body injury. And in this case, that's kind of important, because when you watch the hit on Crosby, his leg is tangled up. He gets hit in the head. There's a kind of a myriad of possible injuries there. And they wouldn't even give us that. They're just saying no upper, no lower. We're not even going to tell you that. So that becomes a game changer, because when we talk about their counterattack of the Penguins, Sidney Crosby's a big part of that, a huge part of that. Like, I think back to game 2 in Washington, he blocks that shot, and then immediately they go the other way, and it sets up Jake Guentzel, that third goal. You know, that's all Sidney Crosby. Or the way, you know, another big analytics is zone entries. And I think back, I mean, he might have had the prettiest zone entry of the postseason, going between the legs, gaining the zone and then flipping the pass over to Phil Kessel to score. I mean, those are players, you know, those are plays that one player in the world can make, and that's Crosby. So this looms large on this series.
So I want to spend just a couple more minutes on hot goalies in the playoffs. A bugaboo and a hobby horse of Neil's, who has convinced me that basically the entire Stanley Cup playoffs is always turns on the hot goalie. And this year's hot goalie appears to be Nashville's Pekka Rinne. Craig, do you feel like that's the right goalie to choose?
Yes, only because Jake Allen has come back to earth, and Jake Allen was, I mean, it was the classic, like, when you talk about NHL playoff hockey, he was the classic, I'm going to steal a series all on my own when my team's getting outshot, and he went out and did that, and now all of a sudden he's up against Pekka Rinne and the Nashville Predators, and it hasn't gone quite as well for Jake Allen, and yeah, I would highlight Pekka Rinne. Cam Talbot has also stole a couple games, but I mean, right now we're looking at Pekka Rinne at a 950 save percentage. I mean, that's pretty lofty, and that's going to be hard to keep up.
Yeah, for sure. Like, if you look at Pekka Rinne and Jake Allen, it made me feel like when you have in March Madness or something like that, where like two upset teams play each other, two underrated teams play each other early in the tournament, and one has to get knocked out. I was kind of hoping to see the two hot goalies kind of extend further into the playoffs. So it's kind of a shame that they have to one
any
has to
can
lose.
Get hot at any time, Neil.
Any goalie can get hot, and Marc-Andre Fleury is another. Name that I think Pittsburgh, you know, it seemed like a bit of a name from the past after the way that, you know, during the playoffs last year and then during the season this year, Matt Murray was, you know, their guy. Now Fleury has kind of come back in out of necessity, and he's played great. And I think he's also, you know, driving Pittsburgh's, you know, run so far.
For sure. And there was, I know there was, you know, certainly externally, when you talk to people in the game, they would look at Marc-Andre Fleury and they said, yeah, you know, he had the good few games against the Columbus Blue Jackets, but people still didn't trust him. And they would say, this is a guy that has a little bit of a history of a breakdown in the postseason, and they've seen it. And I think people were waiting for that to happen to Marc-Andre Fleury, and it hasn't at all. I mean, he's been great against the Capitals, a huge reason why the Penguins are where they are right now. And it's even like created a debate, and we're getting way ahead of ourselves. But now they have two goalies in Matt Murray and Marc-Andre Fleury, and there's a coming expansion draft in the offseason with the Vegas team joining the league, and only one of those goalies can stay, and it's made things a little interesting here in Pittsburgh.
All right, Craig, that's a great little snapshot of where the Stanley Cup playoffs are at. Unfortunately, we have to let you go, but perhaps later in the playoffs we can have you back on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Okay, let's put hockey down and pick up the NBA. When the Los Angeles Clippers lost their game 7 in the first round of the playoffs to the Utah Jazz, the NBA lost Paul Pierce, who's retiring after the end of the season, and his season has come to an end. And so Pierce is one of these sort of players that I assume is a Hall of Famer, but we can maybe talk about that.
Yeah. No.
Okay. We're not going to talk about that. It's already
set. We're saving you from yourself.
According to Basketball Reference, he has a 99.7% probability.
And so he played basically 18 seasons in the league, I believe. He finished with a sort of remarkable 34 minutes played per game, which to me seems really high for a whole career long. So Pierce finishes a career with one championship in Boston, averages 20 points per game over those seasons. As we said, a surefire Hall of Famer. I've now been properly admonished. But we wanted to take a moment and sort of do a little mini career appreciation of Pierce, because he's the kind of player that isn't around in the NBA at this level, at the level of his stardom anymore, as far as the way that he grits and grinds and whatever else, unless, Neil, you cocked your head and you're going to tell me otherwise again. But I do want to talk about sort of what legacy he leaves behind in the NBA, especially as we talk about the style of play in the NBA.
Yeah, if anything, I think the type of game that he plays is more reflected now by kind of star perimeter players in the NBA than it was when he first came into the league. Specifically thinking about the way in which he sort of pioneered this style that we see with James Harden, your favorite player, Kate.
Thank you for recognizing yes. that. He also played very, very well last night, as the entire Rockets team did as well.
Yes, yes, they did. And Paul Pierce was there in spirit, I feel like, if not in person. But the Yeah, a guy that shot threes but then also drew fouls at an incredible rate was something that the league didn't really see that much of from a guard, at least, or from a kind of wing player before, you know, the 90s. Like, you would have examples of guys that drew a bunch of fouls, and that was sort of their game, even as quote-unquote small forwards. And I'm thinking of like an Adrian Dantley or someone like that. But Adrian Dantley was just a miniature sort of like post player masquerading as a small forward or something on offense. In the case of Paul Pierce, he was a full-fledged wing player. You know, he shot from long distance, but then also was able to kind of get into the paint and draw fouls. And he also perfected that great James Harden sort of like up fake, get the guy off his feet, lean into him and draw the foul that we talked about, I think, earlier in the season, that James Harden has used to draw more fouls shooting threes than any other team. He personally has done that, drawn more fouls on threes than any other team in the league during the regular season. So I think there's a lot to be said about how that particular style of play and the kind of elimination of the in-between game that we've seen with like Maury Ball, Daryl Morey, and the Houston Rockets, and James Harden being part of that, was sort of a prototype version in the personage of
Paul Pierce.
Oh my
God, are we calling it Maury Ball now?
People have been calling Maury Ball for
like
a long time.
Money ball,
really?
But changing
like
one letter.
So real quick then, just to correct my ignorance, to me, I thought Pierce was part of the dying breed because he's not a super fast player in the way, or he wasn't part of fast offenses in the way that Maury Ball has tended to push and D'Antoni has tended to push and you know, Harden and the Rockets thrive on transition and on threes, if I'm not mistaken. And so that's, to me, it feels like a different player, or maybe he's pushing a different system, or he's a cornerstone of a different system, even though he had some of the hallmarks of the modern NBA.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, I should also say that the Jim O'Brien Celtics were relatively fast paced for the league of the, you know, around the turn of the millennia, when we had, you know, most of the league was slow and it was still kind of coming out of a 90s era that was kind of more grinded out basketball, and Jim O'Brien, with not just Pierce but also with Antoine Walker, who famously, when they asked him why he shot so many threes, he said it was because they didn't have fours. This was a team that really kind of had a lot of elements to it that predicted what offenses would look like a decade or 15 years later. So I think you're right about the kind of slow-footed, plodding pace of the game in general back then, and that it was probably more able to kind of survive as a player like that and kind of innovate as a player, taking away the in-between game and getting the basket while not necessarily having to kind of push the pace. But at the same time, yeah, I do think that Pierce was emblematic of, you know, where stars would be decade into the future.
I think a lot of basketball fans have a tough time remembering what style Paul Pierce played before Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen showed up in Boston. And I think we talked about this before taping, that Paul Pierce seems to be like Forrest Gump when it comes to like the various incarnations of the NBA and the various trends of the NBA and being president. Like, I mean, that is the first super team, is that
right?
Massive
the big
trade.
Three, right.
Well,
the
certainly,
big three,
yeah, the first that was formed in the way that, like, nowadays when we think about super teams being formed, where you get players
somewhat artificially, as
artificially,
to
right?
Just
it's
homegrown.
Not, you know, it's not like Pippen being drafted onto a team that already has Jordan and then kind of building a super team that way. It was veterans that had kind of decided, they had struck out on their own and found moderate but not great success, deciding, hey, we can join forces together. And if anything has defined the NBA since then, I think it's been that particular moment.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, Neil, and you might have to like scramble to look it up, is there any difference in...
Always what I want to hear.
Always. You love that. Paul Pierce is circa 2006, 2007, when that Garnett trade goes down. What did he change about his game that we can like see reflected in the numbers from rookie Paul Pierce in 98 and all those seasons in Boston that were middling? Then when he gets a huge superstar in Kevin Garnett, as well as like a sharpshooter in Ray Allen around him. Like, do we see anything in the numbers that shows like how he accommodated that?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing is that his usage dropped, and that's not surprising. I mean, I think most people would say
that's a good thing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, like, you know, we've talked before about this sort of inverse relationship between usage and efficiency, where if you, you know, the more share of an offense that you have to take on, the less efficient you'll be, because you're, you know, kind of marginal shot that's being added to your game is more and more difficult. You're having to take the desperation shots at the end of the shot clock. You're having to take the shots with defenders draped all over you if you don't have talented teammates. I think the thing that's really interesting, and I think we talked about this a little when Kevin Durant joined the Warriors and we were speculating about how they would mesh together, is that the 2008 Celtics, when they all joined forces, they were so complimentary, that big three, that they didn't experience any kind of diminishing returns, or if they did, it was kind of minimal. You could kind of take how they had been separate from each other, put them together, and make a prediction based on that, and actually be pretty accurate about how well the sum of the parts would work. And that's a testament to people like Pierce being able to kind of, you know, subjugate themselves within this mission of winning a championship with these other great players. And also just the way in which those pieces really fit with each other, I think, was unique, because when we saw LeBron James join Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh in Miami, for instance, there was a pretty big loss of, you know, production if you were kind of mashing together what they had done on other teams, because there were skills that were being duplicated, and they kind of were not able to harness the, you know, the sum of their parts to be greater than the whole. And in the case of the Celtics, and maybe it was important that was the first super team to kind of kick off that trend, was they showed everyone that if you do have the right pieces and they do kind of, you know, make sacrifices for the good of the team, that they can make this thing that is greater than any of their individual talents, you know, kind of separately.
We obviously can't have an homage to Paul Pierce without noting his status as a quote-unquote clutch player. So from like a NBA connoisseur point of view, well, am I a connoisseur now? No, because I'm like a journalist now, right? Can I be both a connoisseur and a journalist?
Journalist, yeah. Or connoisseurs.
Yeah, sure. My impression of Paul Pierce from seeing lots of like mid-range jumpers at the end of games is that it wasn't just a nickname that he was clutch, but that his actual production in key moments was at such a rate to actually be supportive of earning that nickname, right? Or is that one of those things where it's like he hit a couple shots and like he's clutch and then he missed like nine and we all pretended like he didn't?
I don't know about on a shot-by-shot basis. That would require more digging into Basketball Reference's wonderful tools. But I do know that in the playoffs, his metrics pretty much stayed the same as we would expect from his regular season numbers, which is not to say that they – that's not an accomplishment unto itself, right? Like, most players drop off in the playoffs,
right?
Because you're playing, you know, the best teams in the league instead of being able to kind of vulture stats off of the, you know, bottom feeders of the league. And so, you know, his playoff numbers were pretty much in line with what we would expect from a player going from the regular season to the postseason. And his regular season numbers were also, you know, Hall of Fame quality, as we talked about. So maybe that's a case where he did have a huge series in the 2008 finals, I remember, against the Lakers.
He was the MVP.
That is correct, yeah. And probably, you know, they wouldn't have won that series without him. And that was a big, you know, moment also for the league, where it was this moment of transition toward, you know, the super team era, but also for the Celtics as a franchise that had been the marquee franchise of the league, but they had also been pretty dormant for the previous two decades, for the most part, to have them kind of reemerge on the scene. And they went back to the finals the next year too. So I think when the league's, you know, the classic franchises are doing well, I think that's also, you know, the league as a whole is doing well.
All right, let's leave it there. Goodbye, Paul.
Bye, Paul.
Bye, Paul.
Been a pleasure. We'll see you on some announcing booth sometime, I'm sure. Okay, now time for our significant digit, when a telling number from the world of sports is brought to the crew. I'm going to bring the telling number today, guys.
Nice.
That telling number. Thank you. That telling number is about an inch, which is the amount that Major League Baseball's pitch measurement systems are mismeasuring where the pitches land. This sounds like a totally unimportant thing, right? Who cares whether it's an inch high, low, middle, in, out, whatever. But it's really messing with all the analytics types understanding of who's pitching well and who's pitching poorly and how pitches are breaking. And Neil, can you just tell us a little bit about like how widespread this is? Because it's in every park, right?
Before we go to that, like, do you just mean that like the calibration of their systems is off right now?
So we don't know exactly what's happening.
Okay.
We think probably because it's different in every park, suggesting that each park has it miscalibrated, but Major League Baseball's pretty mum on
so
it.
So they're not all miscalibrated in the same way.
Right.
Weird.
And they've shifted to a new system this year from something called PitchFX to StatCast.
Okay.
And so, but what's really strange is that the velocity is also off. And so everyone's like a mile and a half faster or something.
Something
right
like that, yeah.
And so so everything's very off as far as like what shows up on like the game day, game cast thing on your phone.
Like if I'm following it and Syndergaard, who will not be pitching, but like throws a pitch, it'll show me where it was in the strike zone, but that will be off.
Right. Citi Field's error is whatever.
So it'll be like, oh, it was, you know, 2 inches outside and really it was only 1 inch outside.
And it's really about the break. So like the overall average break, according to our colleague Rob Arthur, who did a lot of these numbers, the overall average break for horizontal break is over an inch. And the vertical break is just under an inch.
Hmm.
And that's the error. So it could obviously be up or down or left
yeah.
or right.
Yeah. And it's gone up since they made this switch, you know, under PitchFX, which was based on cameras. You know, they had a pretty good body of work. It had been in place for about a decade, and the data was kind of, you know, well understood by analysts, and they could kind of – they could even make adjustments, right, for each park by looking at how pitchers perform – the same pitchers, you know, typical pitch placement according to the cameras and the break and everything like that, behaved at Park A versus Park B, and, you know, kind of make the assumption that when a pitcher's on the road, he's going to have like a decent mix of parks, and you can kind of figure out what his true, you know, metrics are, you know, when he's throwing. But then you compare that to the park that he spent the most time at, and you can kind of use that to infer what the bias is in each park. And the range of biases for each park was, you know, relatively low under the previous system. But now you're seeing it being off by sometimes only 0.2 inches. That was at the new SunTrust Park in Atlanta. And sometimes it's off by nearly 2.5 inches per pitch at Cincinnati's Great American Ballpark. So the range is a lot wider. And then the average error is also bigger than it was, not just in velocity, but also, you know, location, break. And I have no doubt that this is something that they'll eventually sort out. And this is kind of the hiccup of any new system being put into place. But I do think that as sports fans, we become kind of spoiled and used to having things be a certain way. And it does speak to also, it's interesting that, you know, last year they had both systems in place and they discontinued the camera tracking one. It kind of now second guessing and playing Monday morning quarterback, it might have made sense to keep the other one as kind of a fail safe or a backup if you run into early problems. So these are the things that happen, and probably we'll see more and more of this happen as we begin to rely on, instead of people hand writing down, you know, stats like in the olden days, they're getting them from these very complicated tracking systems that require a lot of moving parts to work in concert to give you good data. We'll probably see more of this in the future, sadly.
All right.
Yeah.
Baseball.
Baseball. Neil gets all amped up when it's baseball.
Yeah. Yep. You know it.
Neil's a 538 baseball columnist now, so, you know, it's his job. All right. I think that'll do it for this week's show. Thanks to Kate Fagan for chatting about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Kate, have a great flight to Chicago.
Why, thank you.
Neil Payne.
Thanks, Chad.
Thank you. Glad to see you're feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast's stat cast is Jody Avergan. He is himself an analytical model.
He is the system.
We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. Jorge is not going to be with us next week. Jorge, best of luck at Gimlet. It's been a pleasure to have you help man the booth for us. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I am Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.